Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening, Happy New Year and welcome. We're at Talking History on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Western perceptions of the Prophet Muhammad from the Middle Ages to today, the history of the dreadnoughts and how they got their name, a new exhibition on the talented artist Helen Hooker O'Malley, what happened during the War of Independence, and finally, to end the show, we'll find out how the year 1917 was a critical turning point in the First World War. Last week, we looked back at our show at Alexis de Tocqueville, and if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. But first, Western perceptions of the Prophet of Islam from the Middle Ages to today. In European culture, Muhammad has been vilified as a heretic, an imposter, and a pagan idol. But these aren't the only images of the Prophet of Islam that emerge from Western history. Commentators have also portrayed Muhammad as a visionary reformer and an inspirational leader, statesman, and lawgiver. In a new book, John Tolan provides a comprehensive history of these changing, complex, and contradictory visions. The book is called Faces of Muhammad, Western Perceptions of the Prophet of Islam from the Middle Ages to Today. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and costs £25 sterling. That's about €28. The author, as I say, John Tolan. And John, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you.
Can we go straight into maybe the middle of the book and Napoleon Bonaparte? Because I'd never known that before, how interested in Muhammad Napoleon was and how he saw himself as a new Muhammad.
That's right. Napoleon, on his way to Egypt in 1798, he brought along with him a translation of the Quran. It had been translated into French in 1783 by Claude-Étienne Savary, who in a long preface wrote a biography of Muhammad and described Muhammad as a great man, a great leader, a charismatic military leader, great general. And in many ways, Napoleon identified with Muhammad and saw himself Napoleon says this in a number of his writings, both in Egypt and long afterwards. He identified with Muhammad and saw him as sort of a model of how to be a great charismatic leader, a lawgiver, and how to inspire people to follow you.
And he even claimed that his own arrival had been predicted in the Quran.
That's right. This is what he said after having quelled violently a revolt in Cairo. He proclaimed that his coming had been predicted in the Quran. I don't think the Egyptians were very convinced.
What's fascinating in the book is how so many different people had so many different images of Muhammad. For some, he was this fanatic. He was a threat. He was dangerous. For others, he was a hero, as you say. He was a lawgiver, a statesman, charismatic, someone to emulate. And it really depended on the person's perspective. And even when they were writing about Oliver Cromwell, some saw him as similar to Muhammad in a good way and some in a bad way.
That's right. During in 1649, just a couple months after King Charles I is beheaded, the first translation of the Quran in English is published. And in a preface, the translator, who is obviously a royalist, used this comparison, implicit comparison between Muhammad and Cromwell in order, of course, to denigrate Cromwell and to present him as a rebel against legitimate authority and legitimate religion, just as Muhammad had been. But about 20 years later, a certain Henry Stubb takes up this comparison in a very positive way and presents Muhammad as a great reformer who abolished the power of the clergy and as sort of a model for how the king should abolish the power of the Anglican clergy.
And some people's views of Muhammad could change over their life as well. Voltaire initially hated him, but then came to admire and respect him.
That's right. Voltaire originally in his play Mahomet ou le fanatisme, he presents Muhammad as a typical fanatic or archetypal fanatic who uses religion to obtain power, wealth, and beautiful girls. And as Voltaire himself said, he's less interested in Muhammad per se than in denouncing the fanaticism of the Catholic Church. But when Voltaire was in London, he came across a recent translation of the Quran into English by George Sale. And George Sale, just like Claude Etienne Savary 50 years later, Sale presents Muhammad as a great reformer, a pure monotheist, and presents Islam as closer to real monotheism than Christianity was, because Christianity has been corrupted. And Voltaire then comes to see Muhammad in this light. His image of him is never fully positive, but he presents him as a reformer and a monotheist. And as Voltaire concludes, that as he said, Muhammad was un fanatique de bonne foi, an honest fanatic. But in other words, he wasn't an imposter. He actually believed in his divine inspiration.
Is there a sense that people looked at Muhammad and saw and read into him what they wanted, and it depended on their own preoccupations? And you even see that with some of the early American revolutionaries like Thomas Jefferson and how they viewed Muhammad.
That's right. And what I found throughout working on this material from the Middle Ages until the 20th century, while some authors, of course, are really interested in Islam, many of them are more interested in inter-European squabbles. And you'll have Protestants using the figure of Muhammad to attack Catholics and vice versa in the 16th and 17th centuries. And as you say, American intellectuals like Thomas Jefferson, bought in Virginia a copy of the translation of the Quran by George Sale, and very much saw Islam in that light as reformed monotheism.
And maybe we might mention Ireland as well, because someone whose name is somewhat similar to your own, the 18th century philosopher John Toland, he had interesting things to say about Muhammad as well.
That's right. He had discovered a manuscript of something called the Gospel of Barnabas, which specialists now think was a forgery written around 1600 by Moriscos, which is to say the Spanish Muslims had been forcibly converted to Islam. And this gospel, supposedly by Barnabas, one of Jesus's disciples, presents Jesus as a prophet who is predicting the coming of Muhammad. And when John Toland found this manuscript, he claimed, now whether he really believed this or not is another story, but he claimed that this was the true gospel, much closer to what Jesus actually preached than the four gospels that Christians accepted. John Toland did this in order to be able to attack the power of the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church in England, and to suggest again, as other 18th century writers were suggesting, that we need to abolish the power of clergy and return religion to the people.
And it's interesting, these debates continue right down to the present day, and you look at how Muhammad can be denigrated and attacked by those who have a far-right agenda. And it's interesting that some of the contested areas from centuries ago are still relevant today.
The idea that Muhammad was violent, that that Muhammad was obsessed with sex, you see this already in the 12th century polemics written in Latin by clerics against Islam. And you find this coming up by somebody like Geert Wilders, a far-right politician in the Netherlands, using these same tropes to attack Muhammad. And for him, of course, it's a way of delegitimizing Islam in the Netherlands and using that to gain votes for his far-right party.
Okay, well, John, thanks so much for joining us tonight. The book is called Faces of Muhammad, Western Perceptions of the Prophet of Islam from the Middle Ages to Today. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. The author, John Toland. And John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book looks at the impact of the dreadnought on world history. It's a fascinating study. It's called Dreadnoughts, an Illustrated History. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing and costs £15.99 sterling, so about €20. The author is Gerald Toghill. And Gerald, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much.
Can we talk about the era before the dreadnought and, I suppose, the changes that came in the 19th century that made the dreadnought possible? How much of an impact was the harnessing of steam for propulsion, and how much of an impact was the Industrial Revolution?
The harnessing of steam was the most amazing impact on especially seafaring. For the first time ever, people could go against the tide and against the wind. There was an awful lot of hanging back in the British Admiralty about changing to steam. And why not? Because it would immediately put their huge navy redundant. However, it had a number of protagonists, not least of which was Vice Admiral Lord Nelson. He thought of steam as the great innovation to come. And he warned the Admiralty, if they didn't do something about it, then other countries would. And the Admiralty would lose their superiority. As regards to the Industrial Revolution, this meant that for the first time properly, people could manufacture and bend to their will large amounts of iron, which was followed by steel. So that gave them the capability of building ships made of iron.
So talk to me about some of the great innovations then in shipbuilding in the 19th century, because the French had their advances, the British had theirs in 1863 with the launch of the Warrior, that there were some ships that we see in the 19th century that are changing the very course of naval history.
They are indeed, because the Warrior set down the pattern for the ships to come. Again, it was swimming against the tide, sailing against the wind, and it was built of iron, the world's first iron-built ship. It was purely a matter of simple progression for the ships to become bigger and harder and more well-protected and faster and generally beating everything else out of the arena.
And bring us the story then to 1906. That seems to be the year when everything changed utterly, because you have the building of the ship that's named the Dreadnought. It's such a massive breakthrough that the name becomes generic and all battleships become known as dreadnoughts after all, and it seems to have changed completely naval warfare.
It changed naval everything. There was at this time in the Admiralty an admiral by the name of Fisher, famous Jackie Fisher, who was a very innovative man, and it was his idea to build a massive battleship with what they called then all big gun armor. There were difficulties prior to this with ships. The pre-dreadnoughts had guns which were of different calibers, 14-inch, 9-inch, 6-inch, 3-inch. And this made extreme difficulty in observing the fall of shot. Once the guns started to fire, you couldn't tell which guns were firing what, where, and when. So Fisher had this brilliant idea of bringing in a ship that had all big guns, so you could tell instantly where your shot was falling. Of course, in these pre-radar days, it was necessary for people to be able to see where their shot was falling. In fact, there was a piece of equipment in the ship on the top of the mast called the spotting top, where people would go in time of action or in time of a shoot purely so that they could see the fall of shot. Now, Dreadnought, with its all big guns, 14-inch, they had no such problems with their smaller guns. They didn't have them. When they fired, they knew exactly where their shot was falling and exactly where it was in relation to the target or to the enemy.
And what brought the age of the Dreadnought to an end? Was it air power? Was it some other change?
The Dreadnought was a thing of the 20th century. In fact, it was a thing of the first half of the 20th century. Because, like all innovations, they get overtaken by other greater innovations. And in this case, it was air power. These whacking great monsters of ships made absolutely wonderful targets from the air. The pilots thought it was Christmas, birthday, and Easter all rolled into one. Huge targets that they could see from miles away and line themselves up to attack. They were particularly susceptible to torpedoes, and they were particularly susceptible to another 20th century innovation, the mine. They were very susceptible to mines as they were to air power. It wasn't long before the navies of the world realized that the dreadnoughts were really prehistoric, and they were put to rest.
Okay, well, it's an extraordinary story. It's called Dreadnoughts, an Illustrated History. It's published in paperback by Amberley Publishing and costs £15.99 sterling, so about €20. The author is Gerald Toghill. And Gerald, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm delighted. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A Modern Eye, Helen Hooker O'Malley's Ireland, is a wonderful exhibition in the National Photography Archive about a remarkable woman. Helen Hooker O'Malley, born 1905, died 1993, was someone who was inspired by Ireland for many, many decades. And she was also married to the revolutionary and author Ernie O'Malley. And I'm delighted to be joined in studio by the curator of the National Library of Ireland, part of the exhibition, Nikki Ralston, and on the phone by the son of Helen Hooker O'Malley and Ernie O'Malley. And that is, of course, the wonderful Cormac O'Malley, who we've had on the show really from the beginning. And Cormac is also the co-author of the exhibition, the book covering, accompanying the exhibition, which includes 120 photographs. And the text is by Cormac O'Malley and Luke Gibbons and costs €15. So you're both very welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Cormac. Thank you. Cormac, we might begin with the story of your mother, because she was a remarkable woman and she was a remarkable artist. And she's probably a name, though, that a lot of people won't be very familiar with.
That's right. I mean, actually, what I think this show is about, and it's so beautiful to see it, is the love story of Ernie O'Malley, a revolutionary, and Helen O'Malley, who was a revolutionary in her own way. By revolution, I mean they upset the norms of their family. And they defied the family to do what they believed in. She ran away from a Protestant culture in America and came into a Catholic Ireland. And through the eyes of Ernie O'Malley, who had also not rejected militarism, but had departed from it and had gone into the arts. And so these two artists met in America and came back to Ireland and wanted to re-envision Ireland and make it more modern in the arts. And what my mother has done in this show, which is so excellently curated, is go back and visit in 1975, some years after her initial visit in Ireland in 1935, and reimagine Ireland in the way that, with a more modern eye than she had even in 1935. So, as I say, these two people defy their family. They joined up. Sadly, it didn't work out as they had planned, because, in fact, the strength of their artistic quality was their deliberateness, their stubbornness, their intransigence, and that is actually what defeated them as a couple.
She had a background in sculpture and painting, and it's been suggested that that helped inform her photography and enhanced it.
Very much so, because by the very fact that you've gone through the sculpting, indeed, and painting and exercise, and she was also a dancer and did theater work and dress design, so she was a very multifaceted artist. I think all of this material helped inform and define how she looked at the landscape and how she could put an image together within the construct of the photograph that she was framing.
Nikki, they're remarkable images, and I think there's a unique perspective because here's an outsider looking in at Ireland and capturing things that perhaps Irish people might miss.
I think that's very true, Patrick. Helen was a woman who, I think as I got to know her work better, you really get a sense that she had remarkable foresight. As Cormac said, there was a revolutionary aspect to her attitude towards art, and she was picking up on those most modern aspects of Ireland. So she and Ernie collected the works of artists such as Evie Hone and Meanie Jellett. So you can see they were really at that cutting edge of modernism. And she really subscribed to that ethos of straight photography, capture the world as it is. The world as it is deserves that merit. We're not looking to have painterly effects. We really want to capture the true Ireland. And as you say, I think that outsider's perspective allowed her to have a clarity in terms of what she was looking at, that she would be drawn to things that perhaps someone who was born, bred, lived all their life in Ireland might accept as the norm, but to Helen actually seemed quite extraordinary and really worthy of note and worthy of highlighting.
And she had a great range as well, because some of the images are of landscapes, like, say, for example, there's a great image of Crookpatrick, but she was also great at photographing people, the people around her circle, people like Mary Lavin, and she captured the person as they were. She didn't try to create an idealised image of them.
I think that's so true. Helen's friends were so important to her. She very quickly established her own creative circle when she came to Ireland in the 1930s, and she maintained and enlarged that group of friends right up until the 1980s. And as you say, in portraits such as those that we feature in the exhibition of Mary Lavin or Paddy Maloney or Eileen O'Casey, they're wonderful portraits in themselves. They're wonderful studies. Often they were taken, if you like, almost as sketches for sculptures that she would hope to do at a later stage. And so you see she's really interested in revealing the form of the face. But I really think there's actually a tremendous psychological depth in many of those photographs as well. If you look at an image such as that of Moira Comerford, the revolutionary, a former revolutionary colleague of Ernie's from the independence period, and, you know, this is a woman at the end of her life. We literally see her life written across her face. It's a very moving portrait, I think. And Helen was obviously very good at putting people at their ease, that they were able to reveal their inner personalities, I suppose, to some extent, in those portraits.
Cormac, do you think that helped her, the fact that she was an outsider looking in at Ireland, that she had this great love of Ireland, she was inspired by it and inspired by the historic monuments that she photographed and the people and the landscapes, but she had this independent perspective and that gave her a unique vision?
Well, definitely being an outsider was a great help, because but there was another factor, which was she was an independent outsider, namely, and as was true of many of the women in the movements, in the art movement in Dublin, they could afford to do the art themselves because they were not dependent upon the art that they produced. And my mother never sold anything. She never became a professional. And that gave her the total independence. So she could literally refuse to do somebody if they wanted to have their portrait be done, because that wasn't what she was about. So this independence, both in terms of means and attitude, was really gave her the total freedom to, you know, come and go from the east to the west. She had this beautiful house where I was raised in Bearshill Lodge, County Mayo, and she was able to set up her own studio in Dublin when she wanted to do the sculpture. So, yes, that was a very important element in her being an outsider.
Nikki, what do you think is the significance of the exhibition? Is it that we get a great insight into an Ireland of the past? Or is it that through the work of Helen, we are also getting an impression of her contribution to visualising this period?
Well, I think actually the works achieve both of those things. And of course, even over and above that, we have something which is quite unusual and which we at the library are really delighted about. We have a female perspective. Now, I think there's more awareness of the fact that female history is not as well represented in our national archives and libraries and galleries. But what's wonderful in the generosity that Helen and Cormac had in gifting these works to the National Library of Ireland is it allows us to put on this show now. So it was wonderful that, as Cormac said, Helen had that independence, she had that confidence, she valued her work and she felt it was important that there would be a chance for it to be shared at a later date with the Irish public. That was really important to her. And she had the foresight to be able to gift it to a national cultural institution, the National Library, and now we can share it all these years later.
Okay, well, my thanks to the curator of the exhibition, Nikki Ralston, and Cormac O'Malley, who co-wrote the book which accompanies the exhibition and, of course, is the son of the artist being celebrated. Cormac, you wanted to say something there?
Yeah, could I say that, in fact, this was a joint exhibition between the National Photographic Archives as well as the Gallery of Photography Ireland. So the NPA had sort of the 1975 section and the gallery had an earlier period, but they took it down. But they combined in the book, which I think is an absolutely beautiful book, A Modern Eye.
Well, my thanks to Nikki Ralston and Cormac O'Malley for joining me tonight to discuss a remarkable visionary and artist. And if you want to catch the exhibition, it's currently on display at the University of Limerick. And then later this month, it travels up to the National Museum of Ireland's Country Life at Turlock Park in County Mayo. Well, we'll be back with more Talking History after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book provides an accessible overview of Ireland's War of Independence from 1919 to 1921. And it's the story of the Irish Republicans who battled against all odds in the fight for Ireland's freedom. The book is called Ireland's War of Independence, 1919 to 21, The IRA's Guerrilla Campaign. It's published in hardback by the O'Brien Press and costs €16.99. The author is Lorcan Collins. And Lorcan, you're very welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Patrick. Delighted to be back.
It's a very striking image on the cover, so maybe we might begin with that. Can you describe that to our listeners?
Great. I really love the image. We got it from the military archives and it's 10 fairly dishevelled looking individuals, but they're the Clonmult IRA, East Cork IRA. And I'm not sure when the photograph was taken, but it probably around late 1920, but by February 1921, the Clonmult IRA were surrounded by the British Army. And there was a fair fight. It was the IRA's biggest setback. And they lost 12 men in total as a result of it. But the infamous Black and Tans arrived and they lined up those IRA that surrendered. And they put guns into their mouths and shot 7 of them dead. One of the men in the image, he survived being shot by the Tans. And then the British sentenced him to be executed, but his execution was set for August 1921. So in actual fact, he was reprieved because of the truce. So he's an incredibly lucky individual, but he must have carried a terrible amount of survivor's guilt. Pat Higgins was his name. But it's an amazing image because the IRA clearly at this stage were made up of farm labourers in the countryside and in the city, mostly individuals who would be from the working class. And it's just a fantastic picture. But 7 of the people from that one image were killed in that one battle out of 10.
And it's interesting you mentioned the Black and Tans. There's some unexpected stories of humanity in the book. For example, the stories of some British Army soldiers who mutinied in India because they were horrified by what they were hearing the Black and Tans were doing back in Ireland.
Yeah, it's quite incredible how our nation's history could have affected India as well. The Connacht Rangers mutiny, as it was in Jullundar province and nearby in Solon as well, they refused to appear on parade, refused to acknowledge the orders they were given, and three or four of them were locked up, and then the fellows who went to lock them up refused to lock them up, and then it just spread very, very quickly. Local Indians gave them cloths, and they fashioned some Irish tricolours and hoisted them up above the barracks. But imagine if it spread to a second barracks, but imagine if it had spread more all over India. Our revolution might have kind of led to Indian independence even with greater speed, if you will. They were fairly brutally treated. And one individual in particular, I think his name was John Joe Daly from Westmeath, from Tyrrell's Pass, was executed as a result. And the military archives have a very good account of his execution, which is easy to find. But whether it was exaggerated or not, one individual said that he saw John Joe take his shirt off in front of the firing squad and challenged them to do their worst. He said, "Not one man amongst you will say you put a bullet through the shirt of John Joe Daly."
How would you describe the War of Independence? Because it wasn't a regular conflict, but as your book shows, there was a huge range of attacks on all levels on British rule in Ireland. So it was an effective campaign, but it was perhaps a different kind of campaign.
Yeah, well, in comparison to 1916, obviously, this is a completely different sort of fight. Michael Collins always said, "We won't hole ourselves up in buildings again the way we did in 16. This time we're going to fight them like the Boers." Now, every fellow in every bar in Dublin will tell you that we invented guerrilla warfare. Well, of course we didn't invent guerrilla warfare, but I always say we perfected it, and we took it to a great level of brilliance as well. And I would argue quite vociferously that we won the war, because the British brought us to the negotiating table. They asked us for a truce. But if we won the war, we lost the negotiations for the future of our nation. That's quite clear as well. But I think it was a very well-supported war, despite the atrocities that were committed by the TANs and the reprisals that were carried out by the auxiliaries as well. And of course, the auxiliaries come across in this book as being the absolute worst of all. There were, believe it or not, worse than the TANs. And we tend to lump them all in together. And of course, people who were attacked very rarely took the time to notice whether they were wearing auxiliary uniforms or black and tan uniforms. So I guess we tended to just say it was the TANs all the time. But sometimes they did things that were atrocious. And then other times, in particular situations, they helped people put out fires that the British Army had lit. So it's interesting that on a local level, it just depends on who the commander was.
And you also tell the story of parts of the guerrilla warfare campaign, like the role of the squad.
Well, the squad were absolutely incredible. And it's very difficult to nominate exactly who the squad were. But again, in the book, I kind of try to show that there were really two squads, you know. The whole kind of myth of the 12 apostles is somewhat a myth. So there were quite well-trained individuals, and Michael Collins, of course, hand-picked those individuals to carry out very effective operations, including the shooting of three detective sergeants, or G-men as we call them. The police were divided alphabetically A, B, C, D, E, F, and G Division were the detectives, or the G men. But Hoey and Barton and Smith were three of the detectives who Collins consistently told to stand down from carrying out their political work. But they refused to do so, and the three of them were summarily executed by the squad. They're also the three detectives who went amongst the 1916 prisoners to choose who should be singled out for special treatment. So Vinnie Byrne is very interesting in that he says, if you had seen the face on Sean McDiarmid when Smith picked him out, I think he called him a carrion crow when he singled him out for special attention. You'd have had no compunction shooting him yourself.
If you were living in Ireland in those years, would you have been aware that there was a war going on around you, or did it depend on where in the country you were?
Very much so. On a daily basis, there was, every front page had news of people who had been killed or people whose houses had been burned or attacked. You were very much aware of the whole war going on all around you. Now, in individual counties, there was more action. Like, for instance, Cork could claim, just on a rough estimate, to have engaged the British twice or three times more than everybody else. So quite a fair bit about the book is centred around the Munster area. You couldn't have missed the war, though. You know, there were one or two counties, I'm not going to single them out here, where there wasn't very much action, but those newspapers would have reported on other events. And there's a figure I use in the book that I got from the military archives, that on the 11th of July 1921, when we had a truce, there were 115,000 IRA on the nominal rolls, which is a shockingly large figure. Now, not all of those guys were out in the field all the time, but they were always there ready to replace others should those ones need to be replaced.
I'm very struck by what you said earlier about the winning the war and bringing the British to the negotiating table, but perhaps not making the most of what came afterwards. Michael Collins argued that they didn't have the manpower or the resources to continue the struggle. Do you think that they should have or could have?
Well, do you know, there's one very important event, and that is the development of the Thompson submachine gun. And we had ordered the first 850 Tommy guns from America. They were made by the Colt Corporation, and they took the .45, and a couple of them arrived here, and they were used in what's called the Drumcondra ambush on a train load of British soldiers. If those weapons had not been captured in June on the New Jersey docks, I think the war would have taken a completely other direction. However, it's quite clear that those weapons did eventually arrive into Ireland because they were used in the Civil War. And in fact, they were used by the Provisional IRA right up until the early 1970s as well. They have very early numbers, you know, T000325, that kind of number on them. But yes, certainly we were beginning to run out of weapons. That was a big issue. So when the truce was offered by the British, I can understand why they seized at that moment to take the chance to negotiate.
And it's an exciting decade that we're living through with the centenaries. How do you think the War of Independence should be remembered?
Well, I think we should commemorate and as much as possible look into the past. I'm obviously very interested in our history. And I think as we approach the Civil War, in 2022-2023. Some people say, oh, we shouldn't mention it. I think we need to scratch that wound. I think we need to examine it, and we need to try and heal it a bit better than we did the last time, which was to just bury it under the carpet and kind of, you know, stamp it down, if you will. So I am very much enjoying the decade that we're living. It's a great time to be alive. It's fantastic for all historians in Ireland to be part of it. And it's up to the people as well to do what they want, and not to always wait for, you know, any government to do something. You know, things can be done on a local level. We should really kind of try and capitalise on the great spirit that was revived in 2016. And certainly for 1919 to 21, I think we should commemorate as much as possible.
Well, Lorcan Collins is one of those people who have helped bring that history to life, and he does it again in this new book. It's called Ireland's War of Independence, 1919 to 21, the IRA's guerrilla campaign. It's published in hardback by the O'Brien Press and costs €16.99. The author, Lorcan Collins. And Lorcan, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. 1917 was a year of calamitous events and one of pivotal importance in the development of the First World War. And a new book shows how, in this one year, the war was transformed, but also what drove the conflict onwards and how it continued to escalate. The book is called 1917, War, Peace and Revolution. It's published in paperback by Oxford University Press and costs £14.99 sterling, so about €17. The author is David Stevenson. And David, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Great to be with you this evening.
Could we put maybe 1917 in context for us? The war had been going on for a number of years and it was still to keep going. What was happening in that year?
Well, if I put it in context, I think there are two big turning points in the history of World War I. 1917 is the second. The first big turning point is at the end of 1914, when the war ceases to be mobile, and you enter the sort of what we think of as the classic terrible period of trench warfare, particularly in France and Belgium, but also on the other fronts, where the armies were locked in close conflict with each other and short distances apart, equipped with very powerful weaponry, huge casualties and long battles by 1916, battles lasting months and hundreds of thousands of casualties and advancing perhaps 6 miles. So you have this very long stalemate period in the middle part of the war when there are huge casualties and there seems to be very little movement. And then 1917, the war starts to free itself up and you begin to see the new conditions shaping up, which led eventually to the war concluding in 1918, first in the east of Europe and then in the west. So I see 1917 as a military turning point, but it's also a political turning point. This is when the United States enters the war. That has really important consequences. And, of course, the other huge event is the Russian Revolution, which also takes place, really two phases of it. There's the first phase in February 1917, when Tsar Nicholas II is overthrown. The second phase in the autumn, when Lenin and the Bolsheviks, soon to be the Communist Party, seize power. So that's the sort of big picture of what's going on.
Let's look at the first of those, maybe, the decision by the United States to enter the war. Was it as simple as Germany making a mistake with its unrestricted submarine warfare campaign?
That was an essential part of it. On the German side, a gamble that they take, really, is to adopt once again something called unrestricted submarine warfare, which they knew the Americans strongly opposed and was likely to bring the Americans into the war. Nonetheless, they did it, and that did bring America into war. What the Germans had hoped was that with unrestricted submarine warfare, they could starve Britain out within 5 months. That fails, and so what they end up with is a gamble that's gone wrong, with Britain not starved out and America in the war. But unrestricted submarine warfare means, in substance, in summary, that the German U-boats were given the free rein to torpedo anything they saw afloat around the shores of the British Isles and France. That included not just merchant ships and warships, but also passenger liners, even hospital ships. Anything that they saw afloat in their so-called war zone around the British Isles was liable to be sunk without warning, could be torpedoed without warning, so that no time was given for the crew and the passengers to get off into the lifeboats. The ship was sunk and went down with no attempt to rescue the passengers. There's a lot of cruelty associated with it, deliberate cruelty, machine gunning the survivors, forcing them to get off their lifeboats into the water. The whole thing was designed to be terror tactics, to frighten merchant seamen, stop them from putting out to sea, and particularly to discourage neutral merchant fleets like Norway's from trying to enter British harbours. So there's an element of deliberate terrorism in it, and that word terrorism was used at the time to describe what the Germans were doing. Whether this is enough to explain American entry into the war, it is on its own, I think. It was seen as strong, the reaction against it in America was strong enough, but there are some other factors too which you need to factor in. One is the American president, Woodrow Wilson, was an idealist, if you like, extremely, extremely reluctant to get drawn into the war. What persuaded him in the end that it could be done and should be done was his vision that if America came into the war, it could use that political leverage that it gained but to change the whole system of international politics, which he saw as an evil system, and to create something like a League of Nations. And the other question is why it's supported by Congress and by most of the American public. And a lot of that is because the Germans, for various reasons, had come to see a real threat to America by 1917. One of the classic examples of this is something called the Zimmermann Telegram, where the Germans promised an alliance to Mexico to regain the territory in California and Texas, which America had taken from Mexico in the 1830s and 1840s, and that directly affected people down in the Southwest. That telegram was decrypted and published in the American press and had a bombshell effect.
1917 also was an important year in terms of the global impact of the war, because you see Brazil and China entering the war. And you also see certain promises being made by different powers. Britain offers responsible government to India. There's the promise of a Jewish national home in Palestine. And these are things that would have an impact on the entire 20th century.
And beyond into the 21st, I think you can say. even for the world we have now. There's several things there, but one of the things is the war becomes global, if you like, in 1917, in the sense that all of the big powers, pretty well in the Americas and in Asia, come into the conflict, as well as the big powers in Europe who've been fighting it since 1914, 1915. And American entry into the war is one of the reasons why it spreads. But Brazil comes into the war for similar reasons to the United States. It was German submarine attacks on Brazilian shipping. Though Brazilian public opinion was pro-Allied for various reasons anyway, there's always been a strong sympathy to France in particular and Brazilian culture. And there was some political disagreement in Brazil, but essentially there was a lot of consensus once the Brazilian ships started being sunk by German submarines that Brazil should come in. China comes in for rather different reasons, but they were hoping for American help against Japan. Remember, Japan's on the Allied side, but Japan had been taking previously German territory, which was in the heartland of China, particularly the area around Qingdao, which is in northern China, birthplace of Confucius, close to Beijing, a strategic and sentimental importance to the Chinese. The Chinese hoped that if they came into the war, the Allies would lend them money and would give them diplomatic support in getting the Japanese out. And I'm afraid those hopes will be disappointed. So a centenary ago this year, back in 1919, there's a tremendous reaction in China of disappointment that the Japanese aren't forced to evacuate China at the Paris Peace Conference, and that triggers something called the 4th of May movement, which is a major Chinese nationalist movement, very important in Chinese 20th century history. I could go on to talk about India and Palestine.
Yeah, let's talk about India and Palestine because, as you say, global consequences there and long-lasting impact. Why were these promises made at that time?
Well, if I take India first, what happens in India is something called the Montague Declaration, which is August 1917, and this is a British promise of what was called responsible government for India. The cabinet argued a lot about this. They deliberately didn't promise self-government, and they certainly weren't promising independence. One member of the cabinet says India might be ready for independence in 500 years' time. But they do want to delegate more, and that's partly because of the impact of the Russian Revolution and American entry. We're encouraging the growth of the nationalist movement in India, encouraging support for the Indian National Congress, and also encouraging the Hindu nationalists, if you like, and the Muslim nationalists to come together in India against British rule. So the strange thing is, it's actually the bureaucracy in New Delhi. In Delhi, the British Raj, led by the Viceroy there, who are arguing that concessions need to be made for fear of India going. And this might be of interest to you. What they say is India might go the way of Ireland, but there's in fact a home rule movement developed in India, which is modelled on Irish terms or Irish precedent, calling for more autonomy and self-government for India. So the British fear if they don't make concessions, then they will actually lose control of India, which is playing a major part in the British war effort, major supplier of economic assistance and backing the British effort in the Middle East. So there is an Irish dimension in this. The British view the empire as a whole, as a single system. And what happens in Ireland, and where, of course, there's a revolutionary situation developing in 1917, that could have implications elsewhere.
And in terms of Palestine?
The main thing there is for declaration, which is November 1917. Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary, former British Prime Minister. He'd been Viceroy in Ireland. He'd been head of the British administration in Ireland, of course, as well. He'd been Chief Secretary for Ireland at the beginning of the 20th century and late 19th century. But Balfour promises a Jewish national home, as the phrase that's used, in Palestine. This is an open letter, which is sent to Lord Rothschild, who represents the Zionist movement in the UK. So it's a public promise. And it's hedged around with two major commitments. I mean, first, qualifications. First of all, a national home doesn't necessarily mean Jewish state, though in practice, the leading British politicians, including Prime Minister David Lloyd George, expected a Jewish state was likely to be the eventual outcome. But they put in provisos that the civil and religious rights of the existing inhabitants of Palestine, Arab, Muslims and Christians, are to be protected. The second proviso is that there shouldn't be any infringement on the rights and legal position of Jewish people living outside Palestine. And that's actually the big thing the cabinet discussed, was not so much the Arab-Palestinians' rights, but the fear that the creation of a Jewish national home would be a fillip and stimulus to anti-Semitism outside Palestine, in Europe and in Britain itself. Why the British do this, I think there's two levels of explanation. Number one, strategic, that they wanted to keep the French away from the Suez Canal. The Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, had previously ruled Palestine and that part of the Middle East that was now breaking up. British forces actually conquer Jerusalem just before Christmas 1917. The British have the power on the ground to do something about it. They think that if they construct an alliance with the Zionists in Palestine, that might discourage other powers from establishing themselves in an area of strategic importance to Britain near the Suez Canal. And the other thing, and it's the last point, is that the British cabinet had a high estimation of the international lobbying power of the Jewish community. This is kind of paradoxical. They're promising a Jewish national home, but a lot of their statements also seem kind of anti-Semitic. But they think the Jewish lobby is very important, particularly in Russia and particularly in America. So the country where there's been a revolution and the country that's just come into the war, the British think that they can win support for British war aims and objectives by backing the pledge of a Jewish national home in Palestine.
And that was 1917 by David Stevenson. I'm afraid that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History, but I think this was a very good way of introducing us to 2020. My thanks to everyone who put this show together, Susan Calth, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, it's Dr. Livingstone, I presume, as we look at the life and legacy of the Christian missionary and explorer David Livingstone, and we discuss the scramble for Africa. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.